From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Tuesday. The 7th of July, 2020, and so glad to have you join us this morning. We are going to be talking about a range of topics, as we often do on the Dave Graham Show here at WDEV. And starting off, we're going to talk about Vermont's hot real estate market. We have a couple of people involved in the real estate industry in Vermont who are going to be joining us in just a moment after I tell you what else is coming up on the show. In the second half hour, we're going to be talking about another impact maybe on individual real estate sales, what kind of shape to keep your lawn in. We're going to be talking about the Raise the Blade campaign. It's an effort to get folks to mow their lawns in a slightly more environmentally friendly way. And we'll be talking about that in the second half hour. Later on, there was an important U.S. Supreme Court decision last week affecting public funding for religious schools. That's been an issue here in Vermont. There's actually pending litigation surrounding Rice Memorial High School and whether that's a Catholic school up in South Burlington. Rice Memorial, the question pending there is whether students from there can join the dual enrollment program where they can get college credits while still in high school. That requires some public funding. There's been some worry about that public funding going to religious schools. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court decision issued a ruling last week relating to public funding for religious schools that I'm sure some folks involved in the Rice case are watching closely. We'll be speaking with three experts in the latter hour of the program about all that. But first, wanted to get to our two realtors who are on the phone with us this morning and talk about what's happening in the Vermont real estate market. Russ Ingles is with REMAX All Seasons Realty. They have offices in Lindenville and Newport. And we also have with us Mark Montross, who's with Catamount Realty Group based up in Colchester. And gentlemen, I wish you a good morning and thank you very much for joining me.
Good morning to you.
Russ, let me start with you because the intel I've been picking up actually originated up in the kingdom. Folks saying that there's a lot of purchasing going on. It's a pretty hot market right now, and a lot of what's driving it are folks from down country who are thinking about maybe I should get out of the city where this COVID-19 pandemic is really raging and go up to Vermont when I can and have a place to go up there where it's a little calmer as far as the COVID goes and et cetera. What do you hear? What do you know? What can you tell us?
Yeah, I think you're very accurate with that. There's a fear with the pandemic that's going on, and people are wanting to be safe. It's a lot like what we saw with 9/11. People just want to come where they can have some peace of mind and relative safety, and mm-hmm. they certainly are driving the market. We're seeing things that are we haven't seen and since probably the mid 2000s or the mid 90s, I should say, and it's busy. It's really, really busy.
Give me an example when you say we're seeing things we haven't seen since 15 or even 25 years ago. What things do you have in mind? Just properties that may have languished on the market longer that are selling fast, or
we're starting to see where we were really kind of lagging behind a little bit, at least up in my area, and Mark might have a different take on it over on his side. But we're starting to see lakefront properties that probably not as much pricing as just where they were priced starting mm-hmm. to move now. Lakefront now is starting to become a premium, and the only thing that's really keeping it from really, really exploding is prices have climbed, but their appraisals are lagging behind some of where we need to get the prices to. People are willing to pay. Appraisals are a little bit behind, but they'll catch up. But yeah, lakefront is one area that we're really starting to see. We're starting to see, and at least in our area, we're starting to see homes in the mid twos to mid threes to 375s are starting to become active again as well. The more you move north, the prices are a little bit slower, but when you're down in the Caledonian County, the Washington counties, you get a home price in those mid-2s to mid-3s, and there's a bidding war going on within a short amount of time.
Yeah, that's interesting. And are they talk to me a little bit? You mentioned the appraisals, and you say they're lagging a bit. Do you mean they're behind schedule wise, or is it more a matter of the appraisers coming in and not recognizing that there's a price premium out there, maybe?
Well, I think that the appraisers are just buried. There's no question about that. They're working hard. They're doing as many as they can do, and it's not a default of the appraisers as far as what they're doing with values. We have people willing to pay, but they still have to have something to compare it to, and they tend to lag 3 months behind or so because they're using comp sales. They're using sales that have happened already, and that's what they're using to compare the market to. But right now, what I'm finding is that advice I gave 2 months ago isn't the same advice as what I've given to now. I'm listing a place today that we started at 250, and then we went to 275, and now we're at 300. And I guess that advice started about 7 weeks ago. And the last little bit, I said, well, I think that we ought to be at 300, and we're gonna be having some action on that pretty quickly. So
wow, that's interesting. Mark Montross with Catamount Realty Group up in Colchester. Are you finding that in that Chittenden County area that we're seeing the same sort of more heated real estate market right now? And I'm curious about the comparison because Chittenden County, usually the hottest part of Vermont all the time. Are you seeing an impact from this phenomenon of the COVID refugees or whatever?
We are seeing definitely a increase in home sales, especially with the first-time home buyer market, and we're also seeing those coming in from other parts of the state that are looking to move here. So, yeah, definitely the last 4 years have been very active, and certainly this year, in the beginning of the year, we had a very good quarter, and COVID came along, and there was some speculation by some that when we emerged from it, it was going to be a buyer's market, but it ended up being just the opposite. It was almost like the floodgates had opened, and there was a surge in buyer activity. So from our point of view, in Chittenden County, we're seeing many homes come on the market that are literally receiving 3-4. I heard one instance of 13 offers within a matter of days going over asking price. And certainly I've seen that myself, having worked with many buyers, haven't written many offers. I've definitely been seeing it, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. I also agree with Russ that there is definitely a spike in today's homes outpacing historical values when it comes to past appraisals. Some of these homes I'm looking at and advising people accordingly that historical data isn't really supporting it. However, consumer demand is driving it. So definitely seeing some impacts. Personally, I've seen, I've actually just put one on the contract yesterday for a couple out in California, bought a place literally sight unseen, and I just closed on one last week in the same scenario that people bought it coming in from out of state, bought it sight unseen.
And if you're advising a buyer, what do you think about buying sight unseen? Is that wise?
Well, with today's technologies, we have the ability to do videos. Some of us have Matterport cameras that are able to scan the inside of the house, and we have FaceTime technology. So there's a lot of ways that we can facilitate people seeing the property without physically being there that gives them great details. So, I do feel confident. And this is not anything new to me anyways. I've helped people purchase properties in the past that were not physically able to get to the property prior to it closing. So we use today's technologies and Zoom and other pieces to make that function.
Interesting. And Russ Ingalls, what are you finding up there? Are a lot of folks Are they buying properties sight unseen, or just relying on the electronic methods of looking at a property? What are you seeing up there?
Well, I like Mark. We're doing a lot of Zoom tours, YouTube tours, stuff like that, and we're advising our buyers, hey, let's not worry about the color of the wallpaper. That can be changed. Tell us really what you're looking for and what's your concerns, and we'll highlight those in the tours that we do, and we're going to give you the best view that we can. We are professionals in our business. We're listening. We're understanding what the consumer wants. And one time I had nine properties under contract sight unseen, and every one of them went very well without a hitch. I mean, it's nerve wracking. I mean, it certainly puts you on your game when you're being the expert and really paying attention to what your buyer wants. You really want to make sure you're doing a good job and making sure there's no surprises. If there's any concerns, you're recommending, when asked, you're recommending great home inspectors that you've worked well with in the past, and you speak their language a little bit. Everybody has their own style, and so we're seeing a lot of that, and for the most part, it's going very, very well.
Wow. I'm sorry, what was that, Mark?
I think it just goes to show, too, that as an organization, how adaptive we are to changing times and how our value continues to be extremely important with changing conditions, that the Realtor organization really does a great job of helping consumers, both on the buyer side and the seller side, function in challenging times.
That's the Vermont Association of Realtors you refer to, right? And Mark, you're an officer with them or a board member, or?
I am. I'm the vice president.
Okay, that's it. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, Mark. Also, I had asked Russ earlier. Do you have any sense of what percentage of the people in your kind of portfolio of buyers right now, the people who are looking around with you, are would sort of classify as COVID refugees, people from down country maybe who are looking to get up to Vermont because they feel it's safer and et cetera?
From my personal dealings with buyers, it's mainly those that are first-time homebuyers honestly either don't see the value any further in renting, and with today's interest rates, that they could be paying the same in the mortgage as they would be renting. And I think a month maybe confined to small quarters in the apartment may certainly change people's attitude of having more space.
But I think
younger buyers are understanding and realizing the value of home ownership as opposed to renting, and want to take advantage of it with conditions that they are, as far as the interest rates being really positive, that they're seeing it and want to take advantage of it.
And probably 60-40 on my side over here, as far as 60% of COVID buyers, as you've outlined, probably 60-40. But I agree with Mark very much. The first-time home buyer is much driving the market. We have a lot of local first-time home buyers because of the low interest rates, and we're pulling a lot of people out of, at least I am, I'm pulling a lot of people out of on the West Coast, Northern California and the Portland areas, Washington State, Idaho, Colorado, and they've grown to love the politics out there, but can't afford to live there anymore. And they do like Mark's Market over there in Chittenden County. And what's happened is they get over there and they get priced out of the market a little bit, so they're starting to push over east into the Morrisville areas. And they're used to driving an hour and a half, 2 hours to work out where they're coming from, going 10 miles, or they come over here and they drive into the Burlington market, the work market, an hour and a half or so, and they don't mind that, but they can afford there. So that they're kind of expanding our market across the Northeast and pushing up the price points as well. But what I'm finding as well is the stuff that's pushing the prices higher in the luxury market tend to be the out-of-state buyers who seem to have deeper pockets.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, Russ, I'm curious to know what you run into with your buyers when they encounter Vermont's broadband and cell phone technology.
Well, you know, that's tough. I mean, we have a lot of people now that are, displaced workers that I don't think are ever going to go back into the office setting. And one of the one of the requirements that they want are the broadband. I'm still a little disappointed in our politics that we started this conversation about 10 years ago to have broadband throughout the state. Certainly Chittenden County areas, and it's getting pushed over, but certainly the Chittenden County areas have that a little bit better. But still, you get up in the into Franklin, and Franklin County's up in that area, and they're running into the same problems that we're having in Lamoille and Orleans and Estes County, that we don't have the communications that we need. I look at some of the smaller towns that years ago made decisions. Hardwick being one of them made a smart decision about putting in a tower for cell phone and data, and that turned that town into a sleepy little town that probably used to get picked on a little bit into an economic stronghold in the kingdom, because I don't know how many deals I've come out of the wilderness and pulled into Hardwick and sat in some parking lot and closed up the deal that I hadn't been out of service for 2 hours. That is a huge something the state should be really, really focusing on to push them that broadband into all corners of the state.
Yeah, boy, you know, we've had a few discussions on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEB FM and AM about the broadband and cell phone issues in the state, and it still kind of amazes me sometimes when I drive up. I live in Montpelier, and if I'm heading up to the Kingdom, take Route 14 up through Hardwick, and most of the way up there through East Callis and Woodbury, I don't have cell service. And
you better learn to sing to yourself, because that's all you're doing. So
yeah, that's pretty much it. But I mean, it sort of makes me think, wow, are we a third world country or something? Because I mean, this is the main road from the state capital to one of the principal towns in the neighboring county, and you kind of go, that's weird. No cell service. Yikes. Anyway, Mark, I'm wondering if you're feeling like this real estate boom that you're experiencing right now, which has got to be a nice thing for you. I mean, you're getting, you guys are both hauling in the commissions and stuff, and so that's got to be a good thing. What do you see for the future? I mean, if the COVID crisis sort of passes, do you think things will calm back down again, or do you think it's going to stay hot for quite a while now?
It's always a tough question to ask. I wish I had that crystal ball, certainly, to know what the future brings. I'd probably already be retired by now. However, I do see it continuing to stay strong throughout the year, because obviously I'm not seeing any reduction in buyer demand coming out. And one thing that I am starting to see now, which we haven't seen a lot in the past, is a lot of older people that now that have these bigger homes are starting to actually thinking about downsizing. So now we're seeing more homes coming on the market that are larger, people that are empty nesters, and that's basically kind of unplugged the clog, so to speak, where those that are in the middle that are looking to upsize are now able to see inventory come on to kind of go up to the bigger house, which is then freeing up some of the first-time home buyers to be able to get into those entry-level homes. So I do see kind of a nice positive flow on that aspect coming up. So I do continue to see definitely a good, strong, healthy market in the real estate area for the next, at least for the next 6-7 months. After that, who knows? But for now, it definitely remains very strong. The one thing for a point of note that, given this a strong market and a lot of first-time home buyers, one of the things I do notice is people really need to take that first step and get pre-approved for a mortgage. And that way they know what they're looking for, how much they're qualified for, which programs they can qualify for, so they can figure out some of their expenses, including the closing costs, to make sure that when they do find this home, they're ready to act on it and not be stressed out because they're not quite sure what to do.
Yeah, I get you. Now, let me actually ask you about about affordability, Mark. And I want to ask you because I know Chittenden County is one of the more expensive areas to live in, Vermont, and if not the most. When you have these young folks who come to you, let's say it's a young couple, and the bottom of the market is, you know, 250, 300,000, somewhere in there. Do they typically have incomes that can support that, or is that driving too many people? That kind of bottom of the market threshold, is that driving too many people just out of the market because salaries aren't keeping pace?
Honestly, the ones I've been working with definitely can't afford it. That is the nice piece I'm seeing, is that the income basis is very good, where they actually can afford to get into that market. I have seen some that, basically, as Russ was saying, they're now willing to travel a little bit further out. So in the past, in this area, I've often seen that 30 minutes was kind of the cutoff time for people willing to drive in order to get to work. And now I'm starting to see that expand to 45, 50 minutes, and sometimes an hour, which kind of puts them in the Franklin County area and into the Grand Isle area and other areas that to make it more affordable so that they can purchase a home. For the most part, I'm seeing that, again, they're still looking to be within that 30 to 40-minute timeline for driving purposes.
Yeah. Hey, Russ, I'm wondering, you know, the other thing that people occasionally talk about around here in terms of, you know, people from the seaboard moving up to Vermont to escape whatever threats they perceive down there, whether it's COVID. The other thing I've heard people chatter about, and, you know, I don't know if you ever hear it from a buyer at this stage of history or whatever, but, you know, there's a lot of concern when people think about climate change and so on, about rising sea levels. I grew up right on the ocean down in Massachusetts, you know, 5-minute walk from the water. And you know, I mean, in worst case scenario, if the ocean levels rise a little bit, some of those towns down there are going to need to be evacuated, basically, or at least parts of them are. Does anybody ever come up to you and say, I want to buy some property in Vermont so that I, you know, if we do face that eventuality, I have some place to go?
We hear that some where, yeah, it's really the fear factor of COVID that really drives it. I mean,
yeah.
Certainly climate change has, you know, comes into the conversation, and but I'll tell you, you know, it's pretty hard to. I've learned a long time ago that you're not going to overcome anybody's fear. If it's somebody's fear of something, it seems to drive the market. Certainly, climate change does come into it. Another reason why we do have people come up here. They just can't believe how nice those Vermonters are. They really, you know. I have a little thing that I tell people and say, hey, listen, you know, we really don't care about your religion, your politics, your sexual orientation, the color of your skin, or anything about that. All we care about, you're just a nice person, and stick your hand out and say, hi, I'm Russ, and how are you? And multi-day showings, and we'll send somebody down to a restaurant, and they'll come back and say, Russ, you were absolutely positively correct about that. We got talking to the neighbor sitting next to us, and we got to get this day through. We're going out for dinner with them tonight. So it's the culture of the people that we have up here. But yeah, certainly the climate change is brought up, but more, I think, right now it's COVID that's driving the market.
Yeah, sure.
COVID, and as Mark said, low interest rates, first-time home buyers, and as long as these interest rates stay where they're at, it's certainly one percentage point makes a difference between somebody being able to buy a home at $200,000 or $250,000 for sure.
And Russ, is there much sort of folks buying land and saying, you know, I might build later or something?
It's starting to get there. I think as these prices start to climb, we've had enough inventory, although it's tight, but we've had enough inventory, and the per square foot cost has been cheaper to buy existing. versus to buy land. But as we start to burn through this inventory, we are starting to see people starting to pick up land and to build. And again, the economy is busy enough where I'm just working with some folks now that just barely put a home under contract. They bordered some of the land that they had. They were going to build. They come up this last weekend to sign a contract with their builder and said, well, we might as well look at this one home. And we were able to put the deal together on the one home that bordered their land because it was cheaper to buy that property still than versus to build what they were talking about. So it's going to get there. Again, like Mark says, we don't know what this market's going to do. We've been waiting for 10 years for there to be a correction on price to push prices up higher. They're there. Are they going to stay there? We'd like to think that they are, that maybe they're going to, that's going to be the new norm. But again, show me that crystal ball and I'll retire tomorrow. We're not quite sure what it's going to do.
Yep. Okay. Well, that is the voice of Russ Ingles. He is up in the Northeast Kingdom. He has is with Remax All Seasons Realty, based in Lindenville and Newport. And my other guest has been Mark Montross of Catamount Realty Group, based up in Colchester. An interesting conversation about the current state of the real estate market in the northern half of Vermont. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me this morning. It's great chatting with you.
Thank you. I want to thank Mark and the VAR, and also Senator Vince Aluzzi helped us there earlier in the year, and I want to thank him as well.
All right. Very good. Thanks, gentlemen. Hey, we are heading into a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News and a couple of words from our sponsors. Before we get there, though, I wanted to mention that we have a news conference scheduled just after 11 o'clock with Governor Phil Scott and other top state officials today. They have changed their schedule up. They were doing them Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Now they're going to Tuesdays and Fridays. And, of course, today's Tuesday, so we'll be hearing from the governor and other top state officials about the response to the COVID-19 crisis just after 11 o'clock. Meanwhile, stay tuned for more of the Dave Graham Show coming right up after this break.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back, and we're going to be talking about a new campaign to try to get folks to take care of their lawns in a slightly more environmentally correct manner. We have with us Chris Stefanik. I'll get the proper pronunciation in just a moment. She is with the UVM Extension, and she'll be talking to us about this this topic in the next few minutes here on the Dave Graham Show. We also are going to be speaking, I think, with Laurie Fisher of the Lake Champlain Committee, and that's an interesting aspect of why someone from the Lake Champlain Committee. Well, it turns out that the way we treat our lawns and our yards really does have a big impact on what goes on downstream, and for an awful lot of northern Vermont, downstream means on the way to Lake Champlain. So we're still trying to reach Lori Fisher and hoping to connect with her in just a couple of minutes. But in the meanwhile, I do believe we have Chris. And Chris, give me a pronunciation of your last name. I missed that so far.
Yeah, you actually hit it right on the second one. I say Stefanik.
Stefanik, okay. And you are with UVM Extension, and is this this Raise the Blade campaign, an interesting name there. Is this a fairly new thing now?
Yeah, we've been doing it for a couple of years, but we're trying to get the word out a little bit more broadly. Spent the beginning part of the project, we actually surveyed people to understand what kinds of lawn care practices people in the Lake Champlain Basin were doing so that we could better inform the outreach that we are doing now. So some of the things that we've learned is that about 75% of people in the watershed that drains Lake Champlain actually cut their grass shorter than the recommended length that we are recommending, which is 3 inches in length. And we know that a number of folks are cutting their grass between 2 and 3 inches in length, and we know that the motivations for them to cut their grass to that longer length would be if it's good for the grass, if it helps the environment, and if it would save them time. And two of those three things we can work with in terms of saying, hey, just cut it to that longer length, that it's good for the environment and that it's good for the grass. The third one, that it takes less time, is a little bit trickier for us to get at, though we have some ideas for how to suggest practices people can do for that as well.
Wow, that's interesting. We'll have to get to that because maybe I'll go there first because I was just thinking, okay. Generally, if I get my hair cut shorter, I have to go to the barbershop less often, right?
Yeah. So the trick here is we have three practices that we're recommending. One is to cut the grass to that 3-inch length at a minimum. The second one is where the sticking point is. It's not to cut more than a third of the length of the blade at any one time. And so that's where you end up having to cut more often, is to not let it get so long that you're cutting like 50% of the blade length when you're doing the mowing. And so that's where it takes kind of the same amount of time, or at least possibly even more time, getting out there to cut to make sure that you're cutting just a little bit. And the reason for that is we want people to leave the clippings on the ground to decompose, because that helps to form healthy soils, because those clippings, the short ones, will decompose quickly and they'll make healthier soils, which will then absorb more water, which is the ultimate goal of all of this. Is if people have longer grass, the longer grass can have longer roots, and water that when it rains comes down, it can soak into the earth more easily. And when you leave those clippings to decompose, it forms what's called more organic matter in the soil, and soils that have more organic matter can hold more water. So the ultimate goal is if we grow the grass longer, we can then have better ability to let water sink into the earth, and less of it runs off into the streams and into the lake, and therefore we can protect the water quality, because it's the earth is then able to use it for the grass growth and go down into the water table for groundwater recharge.
That's interesting. So essentially what a big part of a big ingredient of this project, the Raise the Blade effort, sounds like we're essentially trying to slow runoff. Is that right?
That's exactly right, yes.
And obviously, you know, runoff into Lake Champlain, into the streams feeding Lake Champlain, sometimes streams feeding larger streams and then into Lake Champlain, or, you know, other major bodies of water on the eastern side of Vermont, the Connecticut River has been much under discussion as being affected negatively by certain practices by humans in our environment, obviously, and this is true of bodies of water all over the world, really. But in Vermont, of course, Lake Champlain gets the headlines as our largest body of water, and it is one that has been pretty severely impaired over time by what we're doing up here on the land. And so,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and once again, we're hoping to get Lori Fisher from the Lake Champlain Committee as a guest on this segment of the Dave Graham Show. We have not achieved a connection with her yet, but our folks are working on it back there at WDEV, and hope that we can get her on at least for the latter part of this segment. And my guest is Chris Stepanek. She is with the UVM Extension, and Chris, I wonder if you could tell me what are some of the public educational efforts you are making to get the word out about tips for cutting your grass in a more environmentally friendly way. Is there stuff on your website and so on?
Yeah, so we have this is a project of multiple organizations, and so we have a website called lawntolake.org where there's information about this campaign, which we call Raise the Blade. And one of the things that we're doing is we have business partners that are working with us on this project, and they are mowing their grass to 3 inches. They also have carts at each of those businesses that include Volante Printers and Echo and Magic Hat Brewery and a number of other businesses. And so people who are interested in understanding what these practices are can pick up a card from those businesses. They can also see what it looks like to have grass mown to 3 inches. We have signs, like the election-style signs, that they have on display at these businesses. We also have a number of businesses that are working with us on a research project that compares grass being cut to 2 inches versus grass being cut to 3 inches. This summer, because of COVID, that project is on hold because of safety reasons. But we have, for the last 3 summers, been doing research that looks at 2 inches, sorry about that, versus 3 inches at places like Curtis Lumber and Main Street Landing and Queen City Printers Incorporated and a few other places here along Pine Street. And we're seeing that the grass is more drought resistant when it's cut to 3 inches versus to 2 inches. So you see it mostly at this time of year when it gets really hot, and the grass that is cut longer has those longer roots that can reach down a little bit further to get water, and the grass that's cut shorter, instead of growing its roots longer, what it does is it actually spends more of its energy growing its blades longer so that it can photosynthesize, because grass is out there, its mission in life is to create food for itself so that it can stay alive. And so therefore, if you cut it short, it expends the energy making more grass blades that we see so that it can create its own food and then store that for the tough periods, which would be now when it's super hot or over the winter when it goes dormant. It will store sugars in its roots to use for energy in those tough time periods. So these businesses where we're seeing the 2 inches versus 3 inches, again, at this time of year, you can see the 3-inch doing a little bit better to get past these drought periods.
Interesting. And I would expect that a longer keeping your grass a little bit longer makes it a slightly better carbon sink, too. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't know too much about that. That's certainly possible.
I see. Okay. And when people are thinking about this and saying, okay, I want to keep my grass at 3 inches instead of 2 inches, the very practical question then becomes, well, how do you adjust your lawnmower to as you put it, raise the blade? There are adjustment mechanisms on just about all lawnmowers, aren't there?
Absolutely true. Yeah, so most lawnmowers, the push-style gas-powered mower, on the front wheels and on the back, there's a little lever that you can squeeze towards the wheel itself, and then you shift it to the left or the right to move the deck of the lawnmower up or down. You have to do it both on the front wheel and the back wheel. And so that's one way. One of the things I alluded to earlier about that we have to have people going out there a little bit more often. One thing that I did as a new homeowner without a lawnmower is I invested in a robotic lawnmower, and so that goes and does it all on its own. And on that particular lawnmower, there's just a dial that you set it at whichever size or, sorry, length of grass cutting you want to do. So I can set that between 2 inches and 4 inches, and off it goes. And then for other mowers, following instructions on the manual to understand how that individual mower would be adjusted. We're working with one of the Ace Hardware here in South Burlington. They are helping folks. They have signs on the mowers that they're selling that they can help people adjust the mowers that people are purchasing so that they understand how the new mowers they're getting work for this
person. Got it. Okay. Hey, let's get a couple callers into the conversation. Let's go to, I believe it's Jim in Rochester.
Hey, it's Tim in Rochester.
Oh, Tim, good morning.
I'm just wondering, is this a rural or an urban study?
Good question. So the 2 inches versus 3 inch study, we are focusing in Burlington because it's easy access for the students. Researchers who are doing it. However, what we know is that lawns get bigger as you get out of the city, and so the the impact can be bigger, where people who have larger lawns can also mow their grass to 3 inches, because the same principle applies, where we want that soil to become healthier, the grass roots to become longer, the water, the runoff to infiltrate into the ground. So the more people we can have doing it outside of the city, the better, because the lawns are bigger, so it's happening over a larger area.
So it's about runoff going into the lake.
Correct. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, so we want to promote that healthy soil.
So sometime in June, Vermont Digger had a report that Burlington released another 1.4 million gallons of sewer into Lake Champlain. How many friggin' rural Vermont lawns would it take to cut the 3-inch instead of the 2.5 that I've been cutting for 35 years to make it look better, take to make up that 1.4 million that was dumped by the sewer plant?
So I don't have a good answer for how many lawns it would take, but, you know, there's challenges in many ways, and the thing that we're trying to do with education is everybody has a part to play, and Burlington certainly knows that they have a part to play in making those accidental releases to the lake be stopped, and each one of us as homeowners has a responsibility to try to do what we can as well.
Well, right. I would just appreciate if more people would leave the rural people alone and just concentrate on Chittenden and Franklin County and leave us alone. Thank you.
Got your point, Tim. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Don in Elmore.
Good morning, Dave. I have a question for your guest as far as mulching mowers are concerned.
Mm-hmm.
I bought a new mower here 3 years ago, which I can use as just a regular mower or as a mulching mower, too. And I'm just wondering what your guest thinks of whether that is an advantage as far as the environment is concerned or not. My situation here is I've got a lawn that's mostly Cabot soil, which is not really what you want for grass. And that was one of the reasons I wanted the mulching mowers, to try to save as much of that and grind it up as much and fine as I could, so that ultimately it'll go in and improve the soil. I'm just wondering what her opinion on that is.
Yeah, I totally think you're on the right track. And the mulching mower is exactly the perfect thing. It, like you say, you're grinding it up. It's smaller. It's helping that grass to be able to decompose. And when it does that well, it can make that increased soil organic matter, and that soil is going to be able to hold more water. So you're on the right track, for sure.
That's what we want to know. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call, Don. Hey, we do have Lori Fisher now. And, Lori, I don't know if you heard the last couple of calls, but I guess the call just immediately previous to Don there was talking about it was kind of another case of whataboutism, you know, where we want to address a problem that we might be able to address in some gradual or somewhat incremental way. And then he says, well, what about the big sewage dump from basically an accidental situation in Burlington? Nobody likes to see a city dump its raw sewage into Lake Champlain. That's a bad scene there. But just for the logic of the thing, I have to ask, if you're going to have a city have that kind of an accident in its wastewater treatment system, what is a better situation? Having that happen plus less environmentally friendly lawn care going on all over the state, or that having that happen without the less with the more environmentally friendly lawn care going on all over the state? What do you make of that?
Well, I you know, it's not an either or. I think we need to improve to avoid those kind of failures and overflows in our system. But healthy lawn care, to the extent that you've got runoff, healthy lawn care is going to help with that. And I think that, you know, we have to think about each our individual roles in this effort to reduce nutrient loading and pollutants going into our waterways. And that's what the lawn care program is all about. These are steps that everyone can readily take if you have a lawn or, you know, any property that you care for. there are actions that we can all individually take. And at the same time, we really need to support investments in our wastewater treatment facilities to ensure that they are upgraded and that they can handle the flows.
So not an either or. I think those are the key words right at the top of your answer to the question. And let's see. I think we need to go to a brief break here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM. And we don't need a break. Okay, apologies. Let's just continue with. Let's see if we have another caller on the line. I believe Forbes from Corinth is calling in.
Hello. Yes,
Forbes.
Yeah, there. I guess.
Yep.
Everyone likes a pristine lawn and sublot and everything else. What consideration is involved in pollinators? Those are our bees, our monarchs, yep, and various other things that survive on red clover and various other.
That's a really good question, Forbes. Let's go to Lori on that one. On that one as well. Lori, what do you know about the effects of lawn care and lawn mowing, et cetera, on our pollinators?
Well, I think part of the focus here is having diverse vegetation on any property that you own. And lawns are, they're really a monoculture. So we're not promoting the lawns per se, but if you do have a lawn, we're noting how to keep it as healthy as possible and help it absorb nutrients. But having diverse vegetation mix on your lawn is really good. So having red clover in the mix, not just grass, is a sign of a healthier system. So that's another thing that we're trying to promote at the same time, emphasizing the cutting levels and cutting your lawn if you have it to 3 inches, leaving those clippings on and removing only a third of the grass blade. But more vegetated, more diverse vegetation, buffer systems with native vegetation and also serving pollinators is a really good thing and an important thing for us, anybody who owns property, to consider when you're thinking about how you manage, how you use the land that you own.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, Chris Stefanik, maybe you can help us with this one, but I hear occasionally from friends and even some family members that the whole idea of lawns is kind of maybe outdated and something we need to get away from. What are some alternatives if somebody has owns a home they bought 10 years ago and they're tired of mowing a lawn and they really have some questions about whether a lawn is the best way to go in terms of just what you want for your environment on your property? Are people transitioning away from lawns what are some strategies there, if so?
Yeah, so there's some beautiful strategies that actually speak to the previous caller's question about pollinators. One of those is to install what's called a rain garden. So that would be a depressed area in your lawn that you can plant plants that are flowering plants that like to have their feet a little bit wet. And so you can direct water into that area, removing that area from being grass and allowing it to be a landscaped area of flowers and other plants. There's also the option to plant trees, and those will also be absorbing water, helping in a similar way of what our campaign for Raise the Blade is talking about, and again, shrinking the size of your grass. A third option, and one that you'll hear about sometimes when people have shoreline properties, in trying to minimize the amount of open area that is exposed to the shoreline for minimizing erosion. You can have a walking path, so you might choose to have, say, native grasses in most of your yard, but then mow a path where you most often want to be or want to walk, and that can help to minimize the amount of work that you're doing, giving pollinators some extra flowering plants to nourish them and also become beautiful.
That's interesting. I might have to devote a segment of the show sometime to this idea that I know some people promote out there of actually, you know, shifting away from lawns and having yards go to a sort of more natural, less manicured look and environment and so on. And I'm just sort of curious, but it's not just because I'm sick of mowing my grass now. Come on, folks.
You know. But well, there's definitely an effort to rewild these places and to provide greater diversity in the vegetation that will also hold nutrients and hold the soil, but also provide better habitat. So getting at that question about the pollinators, but also for wildlife as well.
Fascinating. And I'm wondering, Lori, in terms of the runoff into Lake Champlain and so on, and people think about their yards and lawns, give us a couple of other tips for minimizing your own impacts on runoff into the lake. I mean, it sounds like a healthier lawn is something that will help. Are there other steps homeowners need to take just to try to reduce the amount of pollution heading downstream?
Well, sure. And Chris touched on this earlier, just about the rain gardens, vegetated buffer strips. You want to think about that lawn as a sponge, and or that landmass as a potential for a sponge to absorb water and nutrients. And so by rain gardens, that depressed area that you can plant with a diversity of plants that would absorb things rather than have it run off, particularly running off onto hard surfaces where it's not going to get absorbed and it will just go untreated into waterways. So anything that's going to help absorb the nutrients and the water is going to be a value add on your property. So planting of trees, the buffer strips of diverse vegetation, and then you want to think native too, and you want to think of planting a diversity of plants so that you don't have, again, a monoculture system like a lawn. All those things will help you. The rain gardens, a rain barrel too, to catch the water that's running off from the hard areas on your rooftop. Anytime we pave things over in terms of a sidewalk, a driveway, a walking path, or your rooftop, you're not allowing for absorption. So rain barrels will catch what's coming off the rooftops. And you can use them for your garden. You can use them for your plants. You know, it's been pretty dry so far, and I'm, my rain barrel I'm using to water newly planted trees, shrubbery, etc. So all
wow.
That
well,
will help.
Lori Fisher, I've got to interrupt you there and let folks know that we are about the top of the hour and out of time for this segment. I want to thank Lori Fisher of the Lake Champlain Committee, as well as Chris Stepanek of the UVM Extension, for being my guest this morning on some environmental improvements you can make in lawn care. Thank you very much for your time and information this morning, folks.
Thanks for having
me. Top of the hour break for some CBS News. Let's go to that. We'll be back shortly, folks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Thanks for staying with us, folks, into the second hour of our program on this Tuesday morning, July the 7th, 2020. And Peter King of CBS News joins us. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
You have a couple of interesting stories today. The coronavirus story is always pretty much top story of the day in recent months. But you're also talking about... So First of all, let's go to the coronavirus situation. And I understand where you are in Florida. It is not good.
Well, it's not good. We had more than 6,300 new cases reported yesterday. We are waiting for today's numbers. And the interesting thing here is that the age of people getting sick keeps dropping and dropping and dropping. Further evidence that, you know, this latest surge was caused by people partying like it was January when things started opening up Memorial Day weekend. Younger people going to bars, restaurants, having big parties, those kinds of things. So the median age is in the mid-30s, but the governor told us yesterday that most of the people who are getting sick right now seem to be around age 21. So, you know, they're not wearing masks, they're not doing social distancing, and as I said, they're partying like it's January and not in the middle of a pandemic. So, you know, that's a big problem here, and it's been a big problem in other southern states like Texas and Arizona and out west in California, where they have rolled back a number of the rules, and they've done that individual communities, they've done that here too.
Now, is there any talk of, or is there, are there any actions being taken? I have trouble sometimes keeping track of what all the different states are doing, but are some of them actually saying now, whoops, we opened up too soon, we got to close up again?
Well, not quite there, but, you know, we've gotten kind of close to that in a couple of instances. There have been rollbacks in California where they've prohibited some things like indoor dining, that sort of thing. Texas has rolled back a bit and now has a face mask requirement, and Greg Abbott, the governor, had resisted that for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. And here in Florida, well, the bars aren't shut down, but they're no longer allowed to sell alcohol for sit-down service, so they may as well be shut down. A number of communities have put their own rules into effect. Miami-Dade has rolled back a lot of the dining options there and said no more inside seating. In fact, they were going to prohibit outside seating, then changed their mind late last night, because outside it's okay, or at least less risky.
Yeah, that's my understanding, is that if you are doing outside activities, you're actually better off than that brings to mind the whole comparisons that people were trying to make a couple weeks back about the rally that President Trump was hosting in Tulsa versus outside, you know, demonstrations in the wake of George Floyd's death. And it turned out, it seemed that the rally was a riskier proposition than the protests. And one of the big things people point to in that regard is just that the protests were basically all outside, and the rally, of course, was in that arena.
A lot of the protesters were wearing face masks.
That's true, too.
And if you took a look at the arena in Tulsa, or took a look at some of the activities that Mr. Trump had this past weekend, it was like almost nobody was wearing face masks indoors at Tulsa or outdoors at Mount Rushmore or D.C. And, it's less risky outside. Keep in mind, if you're still in close proximity to somebody and people were sitting next to each other at all those events, you know, it can still spread. The doctors have said that. There are people who said he took unnecessary risks, and we'll find out if that comes to pass.
For sure. Hey, I wanted to check in about baseball. I saw that was on the list of areas you're covering today, and tell us what is going. Are we having? I guess it wouldn't be spring training, but summer training right now, or something right now.
Well, two of the camps have shut down though, because both the Astros and Nationals said they were concerned because they weren't getting their test results back in a timely manner, and they've already had players test positive, and there have been a number of players and personnel who've tested positive all over the sport, and there are players who've expressed doubt that they should be playing this season because of that. You've already had some stars like David Price opt out. Nick Markakis has opted out of the season. Some of the Nationals have opted out. But those really are among the biggest names. You've had stars like Cole Calhoun of the Diamondbacks, Freddie Freeman of the Braves, Joey Gallo of the Rangers have all tested positive for COVID-19. And General Manager Mike Rizzo of the Nationals basically railed on MLB for the slowness of the tests. MLB responded saying as of yesterday, more than 95% of the tests are done, and all those people tested are now being tested every other day, and the remaining number of outstanding tests were supposed to be completed yesterday as well. So, you know, we'll see what kind of effect that has on the teams that have shut it down. But, look, it's a scary situation, and there are a number of players who are still on the fence as to whether they really want to play this season. They don't want to take a risk of infecting their families, their children, their spouses. There are other players who seem to be okay, and you know, it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds in the next couple of weeks as they hopefully get back to playing if it's safe.
Yeah, I guess they're talking about an opening day of July 23rd. There's a game scheduled between the Nationals and the New York Yankees in Washington, from what I understand.
Yes, and the Giants and the Dodgers will play later that night out in Los Angeles. And mm-hmm. I know they're of interest where you are. The Red Sox, they will be at home hosting the Orioles, not Thursday, but on Friday, the 24th.
And what, I mean, they're talking about a 60-game season. That's going to be pretty odd. And we're already going to be past the All-Star break, which I guess typically would be about this week or so.
Well, there is no All-Star game, so that doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah. Are they just, I mean, I was going to ask, are they thinking about an All-Star break, you know, in September or something? Or what's
on
the deal?
They're just going to. Season, no. No, not at all. They're already dealing with a pretty compressed time frame and an extra yep. tier of playoffs here. So, you know, they're not going to take any kind of break. It's basically right. going to be 60 games in, I think, 64 days, something like that.
Yeah, wow. Okay, well, I wish them luck. I mean, I know that, you know, people love their baseball. They've loved their other sports. You know, the NBA has been trying to figure out a way back. And of course, the NFL season is just over the horizon. And, all, you know, you got to look at that stuff and just hope that these activities you know, all the fan, the games and the people watching them on TV, it's a huge part of American life. And it's it is definitely something that
The NBA teams are starting to report to Disney World down here in Orlando today, but six teams shut down their practice facilities after their players had positive tests. So, again, it's a real wild card, and I don't think you can say with any certainty that this is all going to come off as planned and hoped for. The most important thing is if they're going to do it safely.
Yeah, and don't just assume because you want to reopen or get things going again that the COVID is going to make any accommodations for you. I think that's what people kind of assumed about, you know, we want to get our bars and restaurants open again, so the COVID just sort of has to go away, but guess what? It hasn't. Yikes.
It's not right. happening. It's not magically disappearing as some people have said that it would.
Well, there you go. Peter King, CBS News, thank you so much for joining me this morning. Appreciate it.
Well, always good talking with you. Thanks for having me on. And by the way, you said hot and humid up there, I heard. How hot and how humid?
Oh, it's actually, this week it's been absolutely perfect. It's been like in the 70s, not very humid. Last week we had some hotter 90-ish, and it's supposed to actually get up to around 90 again by Friday, but I know you're laughing at me.
Yeah, you know that because here in Florida, we've been in the mid-90s with feels-likes in the hundreds. So, you know what, I remember Vermont summers being wonderful, and I hope you guys get some of that cool weather and hang on to it. And
alrighty.
We're just going to dream about a summer up there.
Very good. Thanks, Peter.
Be well.
Nice chatting with you. Okay, you too. We have been occasionally dipping into some legal analysis here on the Dave Graham Show recently, as the U.S. Supreme Court has been coming out with several key rulings recently. This is a time of year when when the fruits of their labors appear, and it's sort of almost harvest season or something for big legal decisions out of the Supreme Court, because they are getting ready to go on their summer break and they want to wrap up the business for the year, and so they're issuing lots of big decisions recently. One that came out last week actually might have an interesting impact here in Vermont. It involves public funding that ends up going to support students who are going to religious schools. historically, that's been a pretty fraught process that when that has happened. It has resulted in legal cases over the years from people who argue that there shouldn't be any support for from the public, from taxpayers, for religious endeavors. You know, the First Amendment begins with the words, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion," meaning basically that unlike England, which has the Church of England and which historically got public support, the framers of the U.S. Constitution and the author of the Bill of Rights wanted to make sure that there wasn't going to be any sort of state-supported and state-sanctioned and et cetera church, state-required as a religion is and has been in some points in history. The framers didn't want that. They wanted freedom for folks to basically worship as they wished and not have to support religions to which they did not adhere. And they're also, at the same time, just the next phrase, "Congress shall make a law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." And that meant basically that folks were allowed to pursue whatever religious faith they wanted to or didn't want to, et cetera. And the balancing test there has always been one that people who admire that part of the First Amendment, I think many of them think that the government's ideal position on the whole question of religion should be neutrality, should be one in which people are allowed to pursue their faith as they wish, but also don't get government support for doing so. So when we get into the realm of schools and occasionally parochial schools, religious schools want to participate in programs benefiting a broad range of kids, the question then becomes, do they get to? Do kids from Rice Memorial High School, a Catholic-affiliated school in South Burlington, get to participate in a state-funded program called dual enrollment, in which the students from high schools around Vermont are able to enroll in college courses, get some of their college credits out of the way for no cost to them? Nice state program, one which folks at Rice have argued should be available to all students, including theirs. Others have argued that no, in fact, because Rice is a religious affiliated school, they don't qualify for a publicly funded program like that. Well, big case out of Montana was decided last week by the U.S. Supreme Court, and on a similar issue, there are some differences. We'll talk about those, and let's get into some of the details here with three people far more expert than I, and I'll have to ask if I have gotten most of what I've been saying right so far. I'm going to be talking to Peter Teachout. He's a professor of constitutional law at Vermont Law School, and Professor, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Dave. I'll try to help. It's a pretty complicated area, but you've laid out the basic ground rules pretty helpfully, I think.
Okay. We also have Dan Richardson, who's our regular legal analyst on the Dave Graham Show. He's former president of the Vermont Bar Association, and he is a very active attorney in Montpelier and is helps us understand on our show quite often what's going on in the law. Dan, thanks for weighing in this morning as well.
Sure, Dave. Great to be here.
And finally, Mill Moore is the executive director of an outfit called the Vermont Association of Independent Schools, and he's a strong advocate for independent schools, including religious schools, participating to the extent possible in receiving public aid, because these are Vermont's kids who are going to these schools. And so, Mill Moore, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for inviting me.
And so let me start with you, Mill, because I kind of wanted to get your reaction first off to this decision in the case of Espinoza versus the Montana Department of Revenue. It came out of the U.S. Supreme Court last week. And do you think, first off, are you elated? Are you intrigued? What's your reaction to the decision? And are you hopeful that it might help your cause in Vermont?
Well, no, I approach this from a more factual basis, Dave, rather than saying that I'm elated or disappointed. I'm just interested in what it means for students in Vermont, and my estimate is that of the 50-some-odd districts that have school choice. I think only perhaps 15 or so of them are close enough to a religious school, you know, within commuting distance, that there might be some possibility of students going to a religious school. And out of those districts, roughly 500 students are now being tuitioned. So some very small fraction of that 500 students potentially could take advantage of this if it holds up. Now, I think it's still a matter of interpretation, and Professor Teachout will probably address this pretty directly, that the Vermont Constitution and the U.S. Constitution are somewhat different. But I think in terms of Vermont, the impact is likely not to be very much at all.
The impact is likely to be not very much at all. That's interesting. Let me go to Peter Teachout. Peter, do you agree with that analysis that we're expecting not much of an impact in Vermont, or do you think that there is some element or elements of this new decision that could have an effect here?
Well, it's a little bit difficult to hear what Mill Moore just said on this line, but I'm taking it that you are summarizing his basic position. I think it's important to start off by recognizing there are two quite distinct constitutional provisions that have a relevance here. One is the religion provisions in the United States Constitution, but there's also provisions in state constitutions, including Vermont's, that prohibit, to one extent or another, taxpayer dollars going to be used to support religious activities, religious worship, religious indoctrination. One of the crucial differences between the Espinoza case involving the Montana Constitution and the Vermont situation is that the Vermont Constitution has a very different type of provision prohibiting the use of taxpayer dollars to support religious education or religious worship. In constitutional law, the basic difference is the Montana provision is one very similar to 38 other state constitutions that absolutely prohibits any sort of taxpayer or government aid to religious institutions based simply on their status as religious institutions. Hmm. Whereas under the Vermont Constitution, and Vermont provision is similar to provisions in 29 other states, they basically provide that no taxpayer shall be forced or compelled to support any form of religious worship or education that is contrary to the taxpayer's conscience. So that's called a compelled support provision. It doesn't prohibit across the board government aid going to religious institutions or students attending religious institutions. It only prohibits being compelled to support religious activities, religious education, and religious worship. So there's a very crucial difference between the Vermont Constitution and the Montana constitutional provision that was involved in the Espinoza case.
So really, it sounds like the Montana provision, this no aid provision, I think you called it in an email to me, directs what the state government should or shouldn't do. In this case, it should not or must not provide any assistance to the religious school in this kind of a case, and in Vermont's case, no compelled support basically it really focuses on instead, if I'm correct, the role of the taxpayer, and you can't ask a taxpayer to help support a religion he or she does not adhere to. And I'm wondering, as a practical matter, Professor Teachout, what is the difference here? Because, I mean, it seems like all of Vermont state government's activities, and every time it gives aid to somebody, it is using taxpayer money. It's using money raised from taxpayers. And so how does that not end you up in the same place where you're basically taking money from a taxpayer who maybe does not support the religious teachings that end up being supported when the state does give some kind of aid to students at a religious school?
Well, there was an interesting case in Vermont. I think it was 97, back in the last century, but not that long ago, in mm-hmm. which the town of Chittenden objected to having to provide tuition support to students attending Mount St. Joseph's in Rutland. And the Vermont Supreme Court said the problem with the Vermont law that requires towns to provide tuition to private religious schools is that there are no protections against taxpayer money being used to support actual religion classes or religion worship within those private schools. But if those protections were in place, the Vermont constitutional provision would not necessarily be violated because you wouldn't be supporting religious worship or religious education. You'd just simply be supporting types of education in those private religious schools that was unrelated to religious education or religious worship. So that's a line that both the United States Supreme Court and the Vermont Supreme Court have drawn in common. That is, state laws that prohibit aid to religious institutions simply because they are religious institutions based on their status are of questionable constitutionality. On the other hand, state laws that say taxpayer dollars shall not be used to fund religious activity, religious education, religious worship might well be upheld as constitutional. And I might say, Dave, that was based on the Vermont Constitution, which goes all the way back to the late 1800s. And at that time, there was a strong feeling that it's almost a religious nature. A person's relationship to God is a personal one. A person's relationship to his or her religion is a personal one. And it violates something really fundamental if somebody is required to support religious indoctrination in theology that you don't adhere to.
Well, that is it. That's really an interesting distinction there. And I mean, it sounds like that if Rice has a class, or, you know, just picking on Rice because they're involved in this litigation currently, but if they have a class in, English poetry or something, and it has no religious content to speak of, that state aid could go there, but not to the school in general, or not to... it would have to be shown that it wasn't being used for religious purposes. Is that right?
That's what the Vermont Supreme Court held in the.
Okay. I need to pause here and take a brief break for some bottom of the hour news from CBS, a couple words from our sponsors. And when we return, we'll be back with Peter Teachout, Dan Richardson, and Mill Moore to continue this discussion about public funding for religious schools.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
My guests are Mill Moore of the Vermont Association of Independent Schools, Peter Teachout. He's a professor of constitutional law at Vermont Law School. Dan Richardson is he's a regular legal analyst on the Dave Graham Show and is also a former president of the Vermont Bar Association, very active attorney in Montpelier. Dan, I want to bring you into the conversation here and ask you to give us your thoughts about this distinction between Montana and Vermont on the question of public support for that ends up going to religious schools or students. Do I have it roughly right that under the Vermont legal system, the Constitution, and the support, the court interpretations, that it is permissible for some state aid to go to programs at a religious school which are not religious in nature themselves? I mean, you can imagine a program, let's say it were the you know, somebody wanted to support shop classes at the religious affiliated high school, and the high school was able to say, we're not making any religious icons in shop class. We're making tables and chairs and maybe doing some drafting and electronics or whatever. Is that permissible under the Vermont system, Dan?
It is, and Professor Teachout, you know, obviously, I think described this very well. What I can add is the Vermont Supreme Court actually has recently upheld this distinction in Taylor versus Town of Cabot, which I represented the Town of Cabot on, and that involved historic preservation grants to preserve the United Church of Cabot building that the town had given. And the Supreme Court found that that was did not violate the compelled support clause because the preservation work was being done to the building and structure itself as a historic building, not to the sanctuary or to the religious components of the building. And it was willing to make that distinction. And it's very much the distinction that the U.S. Supreme Court has done. The case on which Espinoza is based or relies heavily upon is a case known as Trinity Lutheran, in which the U.S. Supreme Court found it to be unconstitutional to withhold funds from a Christian daycare for money to refurbish the playground. It was a grant of playground refurbishment that they were denied because they were a religious institution. And this is, I think, the distinction that a lot of the court really hinges upon, which is a religious institution shouldn't be discriminated against simply because it is a religious institution. So if it is a otherwise secular activity that does not involve religious issues or indoctrination or education, it should be, you know, and just because they are a religious entity shouldn't stop them from receiving said public money if there's a general public benefit that's consistent with the grant itself. And that seems to be where both the U.S. Supreme Court and the Vermont Supreme Court is likely to land on these going forward. I think the other case that sort of puts a guardrail on the other side is a 2004 case that the U.S. Supreme Court ruled upon. Actually, Chief Justice Rehnquist ruled upon it, and it was the Locke case that dealt with a scholarship for various colleges, somewhat similar to I think the dual track program here in Vermont, but it was denied because the person seeking it was seeking it for religious a degree in religious theology, you know, basically training to become a minister. And the U.S. Supreme Court said no, that's justified not to grant that because that would be basically the public paying to have a minister created, and that kind of direct contributions to the ministry are allowable to be outside of public funding, to be stopped from being funded by the public. And so, you know, it's an interesting line, and I think it can get very finely cut in certain situations. But in general, I think Espinoza is along that line of limiting what states can and cannot withhold from simply because an institution is a religious institution.
Mill Moore of the Vermont Association of Independent Schools, I'm wondering, let's imagine a case in which a student at Rice Memorial High School decides to enter the dual enrollment program and is accepted into the program and it says, I want to take a couple classes while I'm, you know, still in high school before I get my diploma. I want to take the classes at the University of Vermont. Easy commute from Rice, just, you know, a couple of miles at the most. And the student says, I go to the University of Vermont, I take these couple classes. So far, we're in safe territory. Is that right, in terms of the way the jurisprudence is working out so far?
I don't know about the jurisprudence, but I can give you my opinion on that and my understanding of how that issue works. Dual enrollment, the money goes to the student, not to the school. Mm-hmm. So if a student wants to take a dual enrollment course, let's say it is somebody attending Rice High School and they want to attend a class up at the University of Vermont, the money goes to the student, not to the school. So So there doesn't seem to be any problem with respect to any kind of constitutional provision here. If the money was paid to the school itself, like to Rice Memorial High School, that would be different. But that's a clear distinction there, that that's not happening. So dual enrollment, I don't think, gets into any kind of dangerous territory with respect to constitutional distinctions between church and state.
No, I would have guessed that, and this would only have been a guess because I haven't really thoroughly familiarized myself with the dual enrollment program. I would have guessed that when the check is cut, it actually goes to the University of Vermont, which is actually the place where the class is being held. I mean, that's what the money is for, is so that the class can so that the student can enroll in the class. Is that not the
case?
Does it actually go to the student?
That's where the money ends up. Yeah.
Okay. And here's an interesting wrinkle here. I understand also that when the student is enrolling in looking around at various colleges to say, I think I'll take a couple college classes while I'm still in high school, on the list of eligible schools for that is St. Michael's, which is over in Colchester. And St. Michael's, of course, is a Catholic-affiliated school. Are we back in the soup with that one, Dan Richardson? What do you think?
Now, there's one other constitutional issue here that we really should touch on just briefly, and that is in the Vermont Constitution, every Vermont resident child has a constitutional entitlement to a publicly supported education.
Mm-hmm.
So if, for example, you live in a school choice district which doesn't have a school, then how is that entitlement fulfilled? Well, the way the state has decided to fulfill that entitlement is to give school choice so a student may pick any school that they wish to attend, and the state pays the bill. Now, the state does put a cap on the amount of money it will pay to an independent school, but it doesn't put a cap on the amount of money that you would pay to a public school.
That's interesting. So in that scenario, the tuitioned student, the one who says, I don't have a high school in my own town, I'm gonna have my town pay some tuition so that I can go to this high school in the neighboring town. The high school in the neighboring town happens to be, and I don't want to just pick on the Catholic schools. Let's say it's a Baptist school of some kind, or it's a Jewish academy, whatever. Would we run into a problem there, Mill?
Well, now we're back to what you were discussing with Professor Teachout.
Mm-hmm.
But if that was a non-sectarian school, it would be no problem.
Right. Sectarian school, that does, you would agree that that does create a problem?
Well, I think Professor Teachout was saying, and I think I tend to agree with what he was saying, is that there seems to be a distinction between the compelled support clause in the Vermont Constitution and what the U.S. Supreme Court was doing in their reasoning. And
yep.
I haven't had a chance to really work through that carefully.
Okay. Let me ask Professor Teachout about this question of the dual enrollment program and the student who is enrolled in the school in the dual enrollment program. It could be, let's imagine if from Burlington High School, and they say, I want to take a couple classes at St. Michael's. Are there any issues there in connection with the fact that the money eventually goes to St. Michael's to pay for the student's enrollment there? It's a Catholic-affiliated school. Any issue there?
If there is an issue, it would have to be somebody challenging that provision under the state constitution. Mm-hmm. And as Attorney Richardson said, if the money, the tax-supported dollars are being used to support religious courses or religious activities, then that would violate the Vermont Constitution. But if you're talking about advanced courses in biology being offered by St. Michael's, advanced mm-hmm. courses in math, science, literature, I don't think there would be a successful challenge under the Vermont Constitution as the Supreme Court has interpreted that. Because, again, under the Vermont Constitution, it's not the status, the religious status of the institution important. It's whether there are protections against taxpayer dollars being used to support religious activities, worship, or education. That's my view.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Let me ask Dan Richardson. I mean, if someone were to challenge, someone who's a real kind of strict constructionist or something on the topic of, I don't want to see a single dollar of my tax dollars going to support anybody having anything to do with religion. You know, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool atheist or something, and I really oppose the idea of religious education, and I don't want to see this. Would Vermont's and imagine a case then goes up to the U.S. Supreme Court in which Vermont's sort of standard here, this no compelled support standard, which does allow for some assistance to people affiliated with religious schools, providing that the content of what they're doing is not religious. How do you think Vermont's law, current law, would stand up at the U.S. Supreme Court, given that court's jurisprudence on this type of thing over the years?
Well, I think it would actually fare a little bit much better than the Montana provision. As Professor Teachout had indicated before, you know, these no support clauses in about 38 states are a much newer version, and they were adopted, around a time where there was a fear of Catholicism. And they're often referred to as the Blaine Amendments, because they were promulgated at a time where there was sort of an anti-Catholic push to protect these states. And as a result, they have been seen, you know, they've been a target for people looking to expand the rights of religious schools or religious institutions to receive public funding in some form or another. The no compelled support clause, which I think about 23 states have, dates back to a lot of them, and Vermont particularly dates back to the 1776 Pennsylvania Constitution. And, these have largely stood the test of time. And I think the reasoning that the Vermont Supreme Court has given in the series of cases where it's had to review the no compelled support are fairly consistent with what the U.S. Supreme Court has given. And just in direct answer to your question, you know, that was the exact issue in Taylor versus Cabot, is you had two individuals who felt very, very strongly against the use of these town funds for historic renovation because the institution itself was a religious institution. And they made the argument that, well, look, you give a dollar here, that means you free up a dollar for them elsewhere to conduct religious education or service or worship. So it's a wash. It's effectively freeing up that money for them to do that religious yep. work. And the Vermont Supreme Court said no. That we're not going to look at it that way. We're not going to make that leap of logic and inference. We're just going to look at what is the grant going to. And what does it do? And is this supporting a religious proposition? And because it isn't in that case, or, you know, if you can show that it's not going towards either religious education or furtherance of religion. And, you know, in the Taylor case, we made the church was able to show that this was going for the siding on the outside, not for the sanctuary or, you know, refurbishing a religious symbol of some kind, you know, and because of mm-hmm. that, the court said it's fine. And I think the U.S. Supreme Court would largely find that along the lines of the Trinity decision and Espinosa and looking at the Locke decision from 2004 that says, you know, really only if you're clearly supporting a religious education or religious training ministers doing that type of activity. Now, what's going to be interesting is to see where the Supreme Court draws the line beyond Espinosa, which is the Vermont Supreme Court in Taylor has drawn a line, you know, that's fairly robust in its protection. But the U.S. Supreme Court may draw the line a little bit more circumspect, which is you could see them making a distinction between, you know, the education of a minister and sort of the incidental religious education. So, for example, you can imagine a parochial school where 95% of the instruction is secular. It's biology, history, English, et cetera. And 5% is chapel and catechism. And in that, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court could easily make that to say, well, that's incidental. That's peripheral to the main function of that education, and that should not invalidate. And that would be different, I think, than the Vermont Supreme Court. I think the Vermont Supreme Court, in its jurisprudence, has shown a willingness to dive much closer to the actual expenditure of the money, not to look beyond what it necessarily, you know, bypasses, you know, or allows, frees up as far as money goes. But if the money itself goes to religious instruction, it would take issue. But the U.S. Supreme Court may draw that line a little bit more grayer.
Yeah, that I wonder if. Well, let me ask Mill Moore in terms of the Vermont's independent schools and religious schools. How cognizant are the religious schools that you talk to of the nature of, you know, we need to. Are any of them thinking along the lines? Sort of edit our programming in a way that doesn't raise this issue of having compelled support for any kind of religious indoctrination. You know, I mean, I can imagine a state grant going out to support physical education, and each gym class, I don't know, begins with a prayer or something in this particular school. Or each gym class used to begin with a prayer, and the school has decided we're going to stop that practice in order to make sure that the gym classes are eligible for the physical education state grants, you know, without raising any concerns here. Are people cognizant of all this, or is it more a matter of just people are out there living their lives, and occasionally issues come up, and you deal with them then?
I'm not quite sure how to address that because I think this question of whether or not public money can go to these schools has become more complicated in light of what the U.S. Supreme Court has just decided. Everybody up until now has been operating on the presumption that public tuition funds could not go to independent schools, period. But now that's been called into question. And as we've heard from Professor Teachout, there are it's a complicated question. It's not black and white as the U.S. Supreme Court might have thought it to be. So everybody is rethinking where they're at.
So actually, that's a crucial point there, Mill Moore. And I'm wondering, okay, so right now we have this system in Vermont that allows public school kids to go to an independent school when their own community doesn't have a high school, let's say. And one of the, I'm sure, calculuses that happen when families and students are thinking about where am I going to go to school is, you know, I'm in town X and I've got four schools I could conceivably pick to go to for high school. Now there's this other school, which is a Catholic school, let's say, or other religiously affiliated school, also nearby, and up until now, the religiously affiliated schools have been off the list of picks the family could choose, and expect to get tuition reimbursement from their own towns, right?
That's correct.
Does this ruling in Espinoza actually make people think all of that might be changed, and that we could end up adding the religious school to the list of choices that student was looking at?
Yes, I think so. And then there probably will be a challenge in the Vermont Supreme Court to see exactly how it's going to work in Vermont.
Professor Peter Teachout, what do you think about that? Is that a coming thing?
Well, Dave, it was interesting when the dual enrollment program was being considered by the state legislature, there were two questions. Was if the state wanted to provide eligibility to participate in the dual enrollment program by students attending private schools and private religious schools, could it do so without violating the Vermont Constitution or the federal Constitution? And my basic view was, as long as there are protections in place to ensure that participation in those classes would not be participating in classes that are religious classes, there would be no problem under either the state or the federal constitution. Now, Vermont decided not to go that way. Instead, it decided to restrict eligibility for students attending what the legislature called approved independent schools. That meant that no private religious schools, students attending private religious schools, be able to participate. But there might be some other private independent schools that are also not approved. So the legislature was trying not to draw the line on whether the school the student was attending was religious or not, but whether or not it was approved. And Mill Moore knows more than I do about what schools might be covered that are not private religious schools. For example, the Vermont Academy in Saxton's River, covered or not. Mm-hmm. Green Mountain Valley School. Are those schools also covered even though they're not religious, and therefore students attending those schools are not eligible? I just don't know.
Yeah, that is interesting. Mill Moore, do you think that the legislature made a distinction or was trying to avoid the religion question by saying that we're gonna approve or disapprove schools for inclusion in the dual enrollment program, perhaps based on other criteria?
It's always hard to gauge what legislative intent is because there's a lot of legislators, and but you can only really go on what the ultimate statute says, which is the distinction between religious and not religious.
Wow. Dan Richardson, what do you think? Are we entering an age here where the Vermont tradition of tuitioning from towns without schools people will start to add to the list the nearest religious school as an option?
Well, I guess I would go back to one of Mill Moore's early points that Vermont is not a particularly robust state for religious education. There are a lot of these towns that do lack a school system, that do tuition their students, are in remote areas, and they're small towns. And so, I don't think practically the needle moves a lot. But this is a hot-button topic, and there's money behind the litigation. So I could easily see more types of challenges in the courts trying to open this up, not necessarily because they think it's going to move the needle in Vermont, but because they're looking to move the needle nationally, or because it's part of this national conversation. And so, this does represent, and the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause, and the Free Exercise Clause have sort of been these sort of poles that the court has gone back and forth between. And I think this is the latest version of that, and with the changing composition of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yep. Dan Richardson, thank you very much. Mill Moore, thank you very much for joining me this morning. And Professor Peter Teachout from Vermont Law School, thank you. That's about all the time we have. Gentlemen, it's been a really fascinating conversation. That's about it for today's Dave Graham Show. Stay tuned now for the news conference with Governor Phil Scott and other top state officials on the COVID-19 response. We'll talk to you all tomorrow, folks. Have a good afternoon.